Welcome back to Planet Tax, your passport to the latest developments around the world. I'm your host, Scott Levine, a Baker McKenzie tax partner and former Deputy Assistant Secretary at the U.S. Department of the Treasury. In our first episode, we dove into one of the most significant developments in international tax policy in recent history, the recent publication of the OECD G20 Inclusive Frameworks Side-by-Side Package. In our previous episode, we focused on the side-by-side safe harbor. In this episode, too, we'll reach out to Clarissa Machado in Baker McKenzie's Sao Paulo office for her assessment of the UPE safe harbor and its impact on Latin American jurisdictions. Wenyu Wu in our Singapore office for her take on the changes to the Pillar 2 incentive rules and how certain Asian countries may respond to the new substance-based tax incentive safe harbor. And then we'll wrap up our episode 2 with Ethan Kroll in Baker McKenzie's LA office, where we'll discuss what future Pillar 2 related guidance we might expect to see from Treasury and the IRS. But before we turn to Clarissa, let me take a moment to explain the UPE safe harbor in more depth for our listeners, because this is a provision that could have significant implications for jurisdictions that don't qualify for the full side-by-side safe harbor, but still have robust domestic minimum tax system. The UPE safe harbor has a narrower scope than the side-by-side safe harbor. To qualify, a jurisdiction only needs an eligible domestic tax system. It doesn't need to have an eligible worldwide tax system. The requirements for that eligible domestic system are the same: at least a 20% statutory nominal corporate income tax rate, a QDMTT or corporate alternative minimum tax based on financial statement income at a rate of at least 15%, and no material risk that in-scope M&Es will be subject to an effective rate below 15% on their domestic operations. When this safe harbor applies, the top-up tax for the UPE jurisdiction is deemed to be zero, but only for purposes of the UTPR. This means the domestic profits of the M&E Group's parent company are protected from being subject to UTPR in other jurisdictions. However, and this is crucial, the group's foreign operations remain fully subject to both IIR and UTPR. And if the group has other entities in the UPE jurisdiction that aren't the UPE itself, their profits could still be subject to IIR. This safe harbor effectively replaces the transitional UTPR safe harbor that expired at the end of 2025. It's permanent rather than transitional, but it provides less comprehensive protection than the side-by-side safe harbor. The inclusive framework has committed to assessing jurisdictions against the UPE safe harbor criteria by the end of the first half of 2026 for pre-existing regimes that were enacted and effective as of December 31st, 2025. At present, no jurisdiction has been formally listed as having a qualified UPE regime, though some might potentially qualify. Clarissa, let's talk about Latin America. Which jurisdictions in the region might qualify for either the UPE safe harbor or potentially even the side-by-side safe harbor, and why?
Thanks, Scott. In fact, Latin America presents an interesting landscape when we analyze potential qualification for these safe harbors. Let me focus on Brazil and Colombia, which are the most likely candidates in the region, at least by now. Regarding Brazil, Brazil is particularly interesting because it has both a comprehensive domestic tax system and the relevant elements of worldwide taxation. On the domestic side, Brazil has a corporate income tax of 25%, 10 plus 15, plus a social contribution on net profits that effectively brings the combined rate to around 34% for most companies, so much higher than 15%. Brazil also has substantial control foreign company rules and impose tax on foreign source income. The country has actively participated in the OECD base erosion and profit shifting project and has been considered the implementation of Pillar 2 rules. In fact, Brazil has already enacted Aqui DMTT, so that this requirement it has complied with. Thus, it may have the requirement to qualify for the UPE safe harbor, provided a determination is made by the IF that there is, quote, no material risk that in scope MNE groups will be subject to an effective tax rate below 15% on their income profits, which is an additional requirement, as we know. In fact, we will need to wait to see whether, taking into account Brazil-relevant incentive regimes, the IF concludes that the no material risk requirement is also satisfied in case of Brazil. Moving to the side-by-side safe harbor, as I mentioned, Brazil has a very broad CFC regime. In general terms, Brazilian entities need to tax the foreign income recorded by foreign control entities by year end and regardless of distribution. I would note there is still a discussion on the table regarding how to apply the Brazilian CFC rules in case of controlled entities domiciled in income tax treaty countries. So that's not entirely clear whether Brazil would currently satisfy this requirement. We'll need to wait for a while. And that said, it's important also to know that the Brazilian government mentioned its intention to review the Brazilian CFC rules in the near future. Regarding Colombia, Colombia has a statutory CIT rate of 35%, which, as in the case of Brazil, clearly exceeds the 15% threshold. Colombia also has CFC rules and some anti-abuse provisions designed to address BEPS risks. Colombia has been an active participant in OECD initiatives and has expressed interest in adopting certain elements of Pillar 2. One of Colombia's challenges would be on the worldwide taxation requirement for the side-by-side safe harbor. While Colombia does tax certain foreign source income, particularly passive income through CFC rules, it does not have the kind of comprehensive worldwide system that includes all active income of foreign branches and CFC that the side-by-side criteria require. Moving to the UPE safe harbor, Colombia could potentially qualify if it implements Aqui DMTT and ensures that there is no material risk of effective rates below 15 on domestic operations. As in the case of Brazil, this would require careful analysis of Colombia's various tax incentives and special regimes to conclude on the matter. For completeness purpose, it's worth mentioning that Colombia, back in 2022, introduced already a domestic minimum tax under Article 10 of Law 2277, which ensures that taxpayer pay at least 15% of a refining accounting profit or, quote, utilidade depurada. However, this regime does not qualify as a qualified domestic minimum top-up tax, the QDMTT, for Pillar 2 purpose for different reasons, Scott. For instance, the minimum tax is not calculated based on global income, but rather on a locally defined adjusted accounting base that excludes certain tax exempted or no taxable items. Thus, currently, the minimum tax in Colombia is not able to prevent foreign jurisdictions from applying the income inclusion rule or under-taxed payment rule on low-taxed income derived in Colombia. Well, if we move from Colombia to other Latin America countries in general, we should know that they have not enacted any minimum tax law yet. So their multinational entities will not be able, at least for this year, of course, 2026, to elect either the side-by-side or the UPE safe harbor. So, Scott, now that I talk about the Latin American countries, I have a question for you. Beyond Latin America, what other countries around the globe might be eligible for either the side-by-side safe harbor or the UPE safe harbor? So, Scott, now that I talk about the Latin American countries, I have a question for you. Beyond Latin America, what other countries around the globe might be eligible for either the side-by-side safe harbor or the UPE safe harbor?
Two large economies that are worth discussing are India and China, both of which have certain characteristics that might make them candidates for these safe harbors, though each faces distinct challenges. India has a statutory corporate rate, after adding applicable surcharge and central excise and service tax, of approximately 25% for existing companies and 22% for new manufacturing companies, both being above the 20% threshold. India also has a comprehensive CFC regime that brings certain foreign income into the Indian tax base, and has been very active in implementing BEPS measures, including substantial transfer pricing rules and interest limitation provisions. India's challenge is twofold. First, on the worldwide taxation requirement, India's CFC rules are targeted rather than comprehensive. They focus primarily on passive income and income from entities in countries that don't have adequate exchange of information with India. They don't necessarily capture all active business income of CFCs in the way that would be required for a qualified side-by-side regime. Second, India has a patchwork of tax incentives and special economic zones, albeit the latter is only available for entities formed before March 31, 2021, that create variation in effective tax rates. While the base rate is above 20%, analyzing whether there's no material risk of effective rates below 15% when you factor in all available incentives would require detailed examination. Finally, India might be a candidate for the UPE safe harbor if it implements a QDMTT and can demonstrate that its domestic minimum tax system, combined with the corporate alternative minimum tax that's already in place, ensures effective rates above 15%. But the side-by-side safe harbor seems beyond reach without significant expansion of their CFC regime. China presents a different profile. The standard corporate income tax rate is 25%, well above the 20% threshold. China has been gradually expanding its international tax rules and has implemented several BEPS measures. It has CFC rules, though they're not as comprehensive as what we see in jurisdictions like the United States. China's approach to Pillar 2 is particularly interesting because of its size and economic influence. The country has the capability to implement whatever tax system structure it chooses, and it has been participating in the inclusive framework discussions. The question is more about policy choice than technical capability. For the side-by-side safe harbor, China would need to significantly expand and enforce its CFC regime to cover all active income of foreign subsidiaries, not just passive income and income from certain low-tax jurisdictions. For the UPE safe harbor, China would need to implement a QDMTT or expand its existing corporate alternative minimum tax provisions to meet the financial statement income requirement. It's worth noting that both China and India are in somewhat different positions than the U.S. was when pushing for the side-by-side arrangement, because they're still primarily capital importing rather than capital exporting economies. The number of truly large, globally active M&E groups headquartered in these countries is growing, but still represents a small share of the global total compared to US, European, or Japanese M&Es. Now I want to turn to a topic that's been contentious throughout the Pillar 2 negotiations, the treatment of tax incentives. Let me provide some historical context before we discuss the new qualified incentive safe harbor. The debate over tax incentives under Pillar 2 has been particularly acute in the case of the U.S. Research and Experimentation Credit. This is a substantial expenditure-based credit that reduces the effective tax rate for companies investing heavily in R&D. The concern from the U.S. perspective was that without appropriate recognition of such credits, Pillar 2 would effectively penalize companies for making investments that have positive spillover effects, exactly the kind of substance-based economic activity that tax policy should encourage. Under the original GLOBE rules, certain refundable tax credits and marketable transferable tax credits received favorable treatment. They would not be treated as a reduction in covered taxes, but rather an increase in GLOBE income, thus only slightly diluting an M&E's ETR in a particular jurisdiction. But many credits, including traditional non-refundable credits, were treated less favorably, included only in the numerator as a reduction to covered taxes. The side-by-side package introduces a substance-based tax incentive, safe harbor, that significantly expands the favorable treatment of tax incentives. Under this safe harbor, qualified tax incentives, or QTIs, are treated as an increase to adjusted covered taxes, subject to a cap based on substance in that jurisdiction. A QTI is defined as a generally available tax incentive where the amount is calculated based on expenditures incurred or, for production-based incentives, on the amount of tangible property produced in the jurisdiction. The incentive must reduce liability for a covered tax. Importantly, for expenditure-based incentives, the value of the tax benefit cannot exceed the expenditure itself. The substance cap is set at 5.5% of the greater of payroll costs or depreciation of tangible assets in the jurisdiction. Alternatively, an M&E group can make a five-year election to use a cap of 1% of the carrying value of tangible assets. This cap ensures that the benefit is tied to real economic activity in the jurisdiction. Significantly, M&E groups can elect to treat certain qualified refundable tax credits or marketable transferable tax credits as QTIs rather than including them in GLOBE income. This gives M&E groups flexibility to optimize how different credits are treated. The package also includes important language in the preamble to the recent guidance emphasizing that jurisdictions with QDMTTs must keep those QDMTTs in place and not discriminate against M&E groups that are subject to the side-by-side safe harbor. The inclusive framework notes that the qualified status of domestic minimum top-up taxes depends on their consistent and non-discriminatory application to all M&E groups, regardless of whether a group has elected to apply the side-by-side safe harbor. This is a critical policy point. The success of the side-by-side arrangement depends on jurisdictions maintaining their QDMTTs and not creating carve-outs or special rules for certain categories of taxpayers. The package explicitly warns that conditional or discriminatory taxes will not be recognized as covered taxes, and that domestic minimum top-up taxes that discriminate between M&E groups will imperil their status as QDMTTs. In fact, the guidance provides rather punitive treatment to M&Es subject to tax in a jurisdiction with a conditional DMTT. Taxes paid will not be treated as covered taxes, exposing those M&Es to double taxation. Now I'd like to turn to some of the Asian jurisdictions and how they're handling the incentive discussion. Wen Yu, you're based in Singapore, which along with jurisdictions like Malaysia and Vietnam, has been particularly active in using tax incentives to attract investment. How do you think these jurisdictions will respond to the new framework, particularly the qualified incentive safe harbor? What changes might they make to their QDMTTs and their incentive regime?
Scott, this is really the central question for many Asian jurisdictions that have tax incentives programs. Let me start with a high-level perspective and then get into the specifics for Singapore, Malaysia, and Vietnam. The fundamental strategic question these jurisdictions face is whether to preserve their tax incentive regimes by structuring them to qualify as QTIs under the new safe harbor, or to shift toward other forms of support like direct grants or subsidies that fall outside the tax system entirely. The qualified incentive safe harbor creates a potential pathway for expenditure-based and production-based incentives to remain effective under Pillar 2, but subject to the substance cap. For jurisdictions that have already implemented QDMTTs, and most major Asian business hubs have, the question is then whether to refine those QDMTTs to better accommodate QTIs and whether to redesign existing incentive programs to fit the QTI definition. Singapore implemented a QDMTT effective for fiscal years beginning on or after January 1st, 2025. The jurisdiction has a long history of using targeted incentives to attract specific economic activities. Financial services, headquarter operations, research and development, and increasingly, high-tech manufacturing and digital economy activities. Historically, companies may seek concessionary tax rates for specific qualifying income or enhanced tax deductions if certain substantive economic activities are performed in Singapore. The development and expansion incentive, for example, provides concessionary tax rates for income from qualifying activities such as manufacturing. These don't fit neatly into the QTI framework because they are not measured directly based on expenditures or production volumes. I expect Singapore will consider several approaches. First, they may restructure some key incentives to be expenditure-based. For R&D incentives, this may entail converting enhanced deductions into expenditure-based credits. For other incentives, it's more complex. Second, Singapore may explore modifying its concessionary tax rate incentives such that the qualifying income will be computed directly with reference to expenditures incurred or volume of tangible property produced. Third, Singapore might supplement tax incentives with direct grants, particularly for major strategic economic activities. The challenge for Singapore is to continue anchoring foreign investments and substantive economic activities amidst rising competition globally. Singapore needs to ensure it remains competitive through other means: rule of law, regulatory environment, infrastructure, access to talent, and strategic location. Malaysia has adopted a QDMTT as well, effective for fiscal years beginning on or after January 1st, 2025, like Singapore. Malaysia has made extensive use of tax incentives that target specific industries, particularly through granting either a concessionary tax rate under pioneer status or an investment tax allowance. Malaysia's incentive regime is somewhat more flexible than Singapore's in that it already includes several expenditure-linked components. The reinvestment allowance, for example, is calculated based on qualifying capital expenditure incurred. Malaysia's R&D incentive offers a double deduction based on qualifying expenditure. I think Malaysia will likely restructure its main investment incentives to emphasize the expenditure-based elements that can qualify as QTIs. The country may also consider production-based incentives for its key sectors like electronics manufacturing and semiconductor production, where output can be clearly measured. Malaysia has another consideration. It competes directly with several ASEAN neighbors for manufacturing investment. If Thailand, Vietnam, and Indonesia all restructure their incentives to maximize QTI treatment, Malaysia needs to do the same to remain competitive. This could lead to a degree of regional alignment on incentive design. Vietnam began discussing the implementation of the global minimum tax at an early stage and adopted its domestic GMT legislation covering both the QDMTT and the RIR, effective from January 1, 2024, and applicable to MNEs commencing with their 2024 financial year. Further, Vietnam's current incentive regime relies heavily on reduced corporate income tax rates and tax holidays for qualifying investment projects. In mid-2025, Vietnam promulgated a new corporate income tax law, which includes certain amendments to its incentive scheme. However, these amendments do not fundamentally shift the incentive framework from income-based incentives to expenditure-based incentives required for qualified tax incentive treatment. In addition, Vietnam still does not offer qualified refundable tax credits or marketable transferable tax credits. Instead, Vietnam has introduced an R&D super deduction, under which 200% of qualifying R&D expenses may be deducted. Vietnam has established its so-called investment support fund that is primarily sourced from Vietnam's Pillar 2 related revenue to give cash grants to high-tech projects with high capital and revenue needs. We will need to monitor how Vietnam tailors the fund's activities in light of the side-by-side packages referenced to future related benefits guidance. In addition, Vietnam has strong manufacturing sectors, especially in electronics, textiles, and footwear, where production-based incentives could be quite effective. The country might create credits based on export volumes or units of high-tech products manufactured, both of which may qualify as production-based QTIs, although could run afoul of certain international trade rules. It's worth noting that Vietnam may feel the need to be cautious about its incentive programs if these programs are not beneficial to MNE groups in the context of reducing of their QDMTT liabilities. Vietnam risks seeing MNE groups restructure to lighten their Vietnamese economic footprint if Vietnamese source income becomes subject to other jurisdictions' UTPRs. This may not be a concern for US-parented MNEs as they will no longer be subject to the UTPR or IRs on their Vietnamese earnings under the side-by-side safe harbor.
Very interesting. After just having visited clients in both Singapore and Vietnam this past week, it is clear they and their governments are quite focused on what changes should be made to their incentive packages in order to remain competitive, both in the region and globally.
Scott, one question I have for you is related to the so-called related benefits. Can you explain the concept of related benefits and what guidance we might expect from the OECD on this issue?
This is an important integrity concern that the inclusive framework has flagged for future work. The concept of related benefits addresses situations where governments might effectively return tax revenues to M&E groups in ways that undermine the global minimum tax without technically violating the current rules. Here's the concern. Imagine a jurisdiction implements a QDMTT and collects top-up tax from an M&E group. But then, through some separate mechanism, maybe a grant program or a subsidy, or even a special deal with individual companies, the government returns that money to the company. Economically, the company hasn't really paid the minimum tax. It's just been cycled through the government's accounts. The side-by-side package explicitly mentions the inclusive framework is developing guidance on related benefits. This guidance will clarify when benefits provided by a jurisdiction must be treated as a return of tax that reduces adjusted covered taxes. The goal is to ensure that the GMT can't be undermined through creative structuring of non-tax benefits. In the context of QTIs specifically, the package notes that the inclusive framework intends to exclude incentives from the scope of QTIs where they're determined to be related benefits. This makes sense. If an incentive is really just a mechanism for returning global minimum tax payments to the company, it probably shouldn't get the favorable QTI treatment. So, those are the basic concerns at issue in the related benefits discussion within the inclusive framework. What issues do you see as a challenge to the OECD rule drafters in coming up with guidance that addresses the concern without denying favorable treatment to legitimate substance-based tax incentives?
The challenge I see is, as you suggest, drawing clear lines. Not every grant or subsidy is a related benefit. Governments legitimately provide support for infrastructure, workforce development, R&D collaboration, and other public purposes, which is within their sovereignty. The key seems to be whether there's a direct connection between the tax paid and the benefit received, and whether the arrangement is designed to circumvent the minimum tax. I expect the OECD will provide a framework with several elements: clear criteria for identifying related benefits, specific safe harbors for certain types of government support that are presumed legitimate, and potentially a materiality threshold so that minor benefits don't trigger the rule.
Now let's get back to Ethan. Ethan, let's talk about what we can expect from U.S. Treasury in terms of guidance implementing the side-by-side package. What are the key issues Treasury will need to address?
There are several critical technical issues that Treasury guidance will need to resolve, Scott. Let me focus on two that I think are particularly important. The side-by-side package requires that the U.S. provide a foreign tax credit for QDMTTs on the same terms as any other creditable covered tax. This sounds straightforward, but it raises some technical questions under U.S. tax law. Under current U.S. law, a foreign tax is creditable only if it qualifies as an income tax under detailed regulations. These regulations look at whether the foreign tax is imposed on realized net income and whether it satisfies various other requirements. Some QDMTTs are clearly income taxes in this sense. They're imposed on a financial accounting measure of income with adjustments. But other QDMTTs might have features that create questions. The question is whether all QDMTTs will automatically qualify for foreign tax credit treatment or whether Treasury will need to make jurisdiction-by-jurisdiction determinations. My hope and expectation is that Treasury will provide guidance treating QDMTTs as creditable per se, as long as they meet the OECD's QDMTT requirements. This would avoid the need for a detailed technical analysis of each jurisdiction's QDMTT and would be consistent with the policy goal of the side-by-side arrangement. But Treasury will need to articulate the legal basis for this treatment under the existing foreign tax credit regulations or potentially issue new regulations that specifically address QDMTTs. Nothing in the side-by-side package turns off the foreign tax credit limitation rules, however. But with the favorable foreign tax credit limitation changes that OB3 introduced for NCTI, there's reasonable hope that many QDMTTs will in fact be available as foreign tax credits that offset U.S. tax on foreign income.
Thanks, Ethan. Now let's discuss another technical issue, the impact of not allowing NCTI or NECTI pushdown. That is, not allowing CFC taxes or other owner-level taxes to be pushed down into the QDMTT ETR computation. How does this affect U.S.-parented multinationals?
This is an important technical point that affects the economics of QDMTTs for U.S. M&Es. Let me explain the mechanics first and then discuss the practical impact. Under U.S. tax law, when a CFC earns income, that income may be subject to tax at the CFC level in its local jurisdiction, and it may also be subject to current U.S. tax under NCTI or Subpart F. The U.S. provides foreign tax credits for the foreign taxes paid by the CFC to prevent double taxation. Now, when a QDMTT jurisdiction calculates whether an M&E group owes top-up tax in that jurisdiction, it computes an ETR for that jurisdiction. The question is, should that ETR calculation include U.S. taxes paid on the income of CFCs located in the QDMTT jurisdiction? The side-by-side package is explicit. QDMTTs must be calculated without pushdown of CFC or other owner-level taxes. This means that if a U.S. parent has a subsidiary in, say, Ireland, and Ireland has a QDMTT, Ireland calculates the top-up tax based only on Irish taxes paid by the Irish subsidiary. The U.S. taxes paid by the parent on the Irish subsidiary's income under NCTI don't count toward meeting the 15% minimum rate in Ireland. We next turn to the impact on excess foreign tax credits of this issue. The practical impact of this rule is significant for U.S. M&Es that already have excess foreign tax credits. Let me explain why. Many U.S. M&Es operate in a perpetual excess credit position. This happens when the total foreign taxes they pay exceed the U.S. foreign tax credit limitation. Common reasons for being an excess credit position taxpayer include operating in high-tax jurisdictions, withholding taxes on cross-border payments, and U.S. foreign tax credit limitations. When a U.S. M&E in an excess credit position pays QDMTT, that QDMTT is creditable against U.S. tax. But here's the issue. Because the company is already in an excess credit position, the QDMTT credit can't actually be used. It just adds to the pile of excess credits that are already limited out. If QDMTT jurisdictions allowed NCTI pushdown, the U.S. taxes paid under NCTI would count toward the 15% minimum rate in the QDMTT jurisdiction, potentially reducing or eliminating the QDMTT liability. But because pushdown isn't allowed, the QDMTT is calculated based only on local taxes, which may be below 15%, triggering a QDMTT obligation. The result is that U.S. M&Es in excess credit positions may effectively bear the full cost of QDMTT payments without any U.S. tax benefit because they cannot use foreign taxes generated by those payments. This will likely exacerbate the excess credit problem for many U.S. M&Es and could influence decisions about where to locate operations and how to structure financing arrangements. For instance, some U.S. M&Es may reconsider the tax efficiency of operating through CFCs in low-tax jurisdictions that have QDMDTs versus alternative structures.
Thanks, Ethan. Well, we've covered a lot of ground today. Let me sum up the key takeaways from our conversation. First, the side-by-side package represents a significant accommodation to the U.S. tax system while maintaining the broader framework of global minimum taxation. U.S. parented multinationals will get relief from IIR and UTPR starting in 2026, but they faced exposure for 2024 and 2025. Second, jurisdictions around the world are rapidly implementing these provisions. The UK and EU are moving forward with legislation, and other jurisdictions are considering whether they might qualify for the UPE safe harbor. Third, the treatment of tax incentives has become more flexible through the qualified incentive safe harbor, giving jurisdictions room to maintain substance-based incentives within defined limits. Fourth, implementation details matter enormously, whether it's the mechanics of QDMTT foreign tax credits, the impact of no NECT pushdown, or the future guidance on related benefits. The technical details will significantly affect how these rules operate in practice. And finally, please keep in mind that this is a very dynamic area. The inclusive framework has committed to a stock take by 2029 to assess how the GMT, or global minimum tax, along with the side-by-side system, are functioning. With a commitment to address any substantial level playing field or BEPS risks that emerge. This is not the end of the story. It's the beginning of an ongoing process of monitoring, adjustment, and refinement. Now, I want to thank our outstanding panel, Ethan, Kate, Munya, Clarissa, and Wenyu, for their insights and their expertise. And thank you to our listeners for joining us for this inaugural episode of Planet Tax. We'll be back soon with more episodes exploring the complex and fascinating world of international taxation. Until then, this is Scott Levine, and I'll see you again soon on Planet Tax.